Welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the fabulous fireside room, today's speaker is Chucky Hoff. And he will be speaking on codependence gender roles. So let's listen in on Chuck talking about codependence.
Well, I've been told by people that if I want a milder winter, I should come here from Minnesota.
Minnesota? Oh, that's
from Yeah. You're from Minneapolis? So it's nicer here in the winter. But the really bitter cold, you don't catch much of it.
How'd you feel about that
side of
the
Why don't we go ahead and get started? We're about 5 minutes into time. If there are people taping, I suppose this is the time to start it. The title for today has changed about six times, so I'll make up another one. And what I want to talk today about and have us talk about is the dangers of thinking about people's behavior only in terms of personality. So that's a preview, really, of what a lot of what we're going to talk about. First, let me tell you who I am. I'm Chuck Hoff. A lot of my friends call me Chucky. If you would like to do that, that's fine. In the South, the diminutive is not diminutive, it is merely familiar. I'm a social psychologist, which means that I study how people think about and interact with each other. I've played around in philosophy. I even snuck into a seminary for one semester, but most of what I did there was philosophy. Primarily what I do is psychology, and the kind of psychology I do is this social stuff, which looks at how people get along with each other. This week, the theme of this week is, there's one other claim I need to make about myself before I go on to that, and that's that I'm not trained as a clinical psychologist. So I cannot help you directly with your problems. I'm a nice person. If you'd like to talk to me, I'll be glad to listen. But as a psychologist, I'm not professionally trained to do that kind of stuff. I study more how people interact. The theme for this week of the stuff I'd like us to talk about is how we think about each other. That is, looking at what goes on in our heads as we're looking at another person who does something. How do we make decisions about whether people are nice or nasty? How do we make inferences about what their intentions were when they do a particular thing? Next week, I want to talk more about interpersonal interactions, so how we talk with each other, how groups work, social conflicts, so we'll get a little larger next week. But this week, it's more sort of micro in terms of how we think. A couple of points about this theme and what you can expect. I am a scientist looking at how people interact, looking at how people think about each other, but I don't have answers to interpersonal problems. Most of what I can do is to help you think more carefully about how it works, rather than to say, here's the right way to think. There's a lot of popular psychology out today that will say, Well, take this test. It's clear that you're an ANJP-NTRFQ. Therefore, this is how you should be. And those are useful if they're taken with a grain of salt as some idea of how you might want be different from other people and interact with other folks. But they're not the truth as they are often purported to be in the popular books. So I can't give you the truth. In fact, if anything, I'm likely to make you more confused by the end of this about how easily you can make inferences about other people. So we're gonna do our best, or I'm gonna do my best, to draw us away from simple conclusions and make us try to think more complexly about interpersonal interaction. Having said that, as an overview, I'd like to show you this overhead and give you an assignment. I'm a college teacher. I give assignments all the time. It's fun. Sometimes I even do them. Is that going to stay on there? It did a little while ago. Stay. Okay. I'd like you to look at each of these three descriptions and think of them as, for folks who are listening to the tape, I'll read the descriptions in a bit. I'd like you to look at each of these three descriptions and think of them as the description of an individual. And I'd like you to try to guess the sex of the person that's being described in each paragraph, the socioeconomic status, that is, are they lower class, are they middle class, or are they upper class, and the age. And I'll give you three big categories for age: young adult, middle age, older adult. So as you read each paragraph carefully, think about male, female, low, middle, or upper income, and young adult, middle age, or older adult. For those who are on the tape, listening to the tape, let me read the paragraphs now. The first paragraph reads, "This person is lively and dramatic, always drawing attention to him or herself. The person is prone to exaggeration and often acts out a role such as victim or the prince or princess without being aware of it. This person's behavior is intensively expressed. Minor stimuli give rise to emotional excitability, such as irrational, angry outbursts or tantrums. This person craves novelty, stimulation, and excitement, and quickly becomes bored with normal routines. At first, this person is perceived as shallow and lacking genuineness, though superficially charming and appealing. This person is attractive and seductive. This individual tries to control the opposite sex or tries to enter into a dependent relationship. Flights into romantic fantasy are common." So that's the first person. The second person, "This person passively allows others to assume responsibility for major areas of his or her life because of a lack of self-confidence and an inability to function independently. This person subordinates his or her own needs to those of others on whom he or she is dependent in order to avoid any possibility of having to be self-reliant. This person leaves major decisions to others. For example, this person will typically assume a passive role and allow the spouse to decide where they should live, what kind of job he or she should have, and with which neighbors they should be friendly." Now the final paragraph, can y'all read it even through the overhead? "Person habitually violates the rights of others. In childhood, person engaged in frequent lying, stealing, fighting, truancy, and resisting authority. In adolescence, this person showed unusually early or aggressive sexual behavior, excessive drinking, and use of illicit drugs. This person is unable to sustain lasting, close, warm, and responsible relationships with family, friends, or sexual partners." Now, for the first paragraph, what sex do you think the person is being described in that first paragraph? What's the lively and dramatic one?
Female.
Female. Do we have any dissent?
Well, I don't see how you could say that from what you've given.
That's a hard question, and if you'll hang on a second, you'll see why I'm asking it.
Just tell it.
Can I ask you, is it kind of like a forced choice to go to a stereotype?
That's right, it's forced choice to go to a stereotype. That's right. I know. But it's forced choice right now to go to a stereotype. And in a minute, I'll say, it's bad to do this. So don't feel bad now. What about socioeconomic
gay male?
Excuse me?
I'm going to say gay male.
Sure, go for it. What about socioeconomic status? Low, middle, upper?
Middle to upper.
Middle to upper? Okay, nobody's on the low?
No.
Okay, so we're in the middle or the upper. What about age? Young adult, middle age, older?
Younger.
Okay. The second person, passive, lets the spouse decide other things, male or female?
Female.
Low, middle, upper income?
Low.
Any of them. Okay. Actually, in these demonstrations, that's the one a lot of people disagree on. Age, young, middle age, older adult?
Older.
Older, middle, okay. Now the last one, male or female?
Male.
That's an easy one. Sounds to me like a soccer fan, actually. Socioeconomic status, low, middle, upper? You have upper? Lower, so a spread. Actually, what usually...
Because he might have lots of money, but he's using it all on drugs.
Using all on drugs. So starts at upper and moves to lower.
He starts low and stays low. No matter how much he earns, he still has the same living situation.
Age, young, middle age, older? Younger. The reason I put these up here is that these are descriptions that actually come from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association, third edition. That's DSM-3 in psychojargon. And it's used in these kinds of descriptions, although they look much more scientific on the page, they have little bullets next to them and stuff, are used in diagnosing personality disorders in people.
So you fit them into a slot.
And you fit people into a slot. Now, part of this is because of insurance. Insurance requires a diagnosis. You have to call them sick, so you give them a slot and say they're sick this way. So we don't want to blame it all on the psychologists and psychiatrists, but just a lot of them. But the point is that it was easy for you to guess the social role or the stereotypic role of the people who are getting diagnoses of being like this, and we're calling this in DSM-3, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, sick. So that exaggerated, stereotypical roles get called personality disorders.
Aren't they?
It depends. And that's, in fact, what I want to talk about, is whether, in fact, they are personality disorders or something else. And something else, my guess, is going to be is social disorders rather than personality disorders.
Is there a difference in your thinking between personality disorders and psychological disorders?
No.
Okay.
No, not to me. To me, they mean the same thing.
So let's see where I am on my outline here. Yep, let's go to a popular example that has recently gotten a lot of press and was in the title for the last for this session. Stay. There's a lot of talk now about codependency. Everybody is saying, well, she is codependent, and it is usually she who is codependent. And I'm just, for those on the tape, I'm just going to read through these diagnostic criteria. These are the kinds of things you see in manuals for diagnosing codependency. If you cover for another person's bad behavior, if you frequently talk or worry about other people's problems, if you take on more responsibility than you should, if you ignore your own needs, if you worry that if you leave a relationship, the other person will fall apart, if your self-esteem depends upon what others say and think about you, if you want to be a good person, need other people, if you're dependent on your relationships, and if you're too unselfish, you're codependent. But this is the stereotypical women's role in our society, is to care for others. It's a caretaking role. Now, I'm not arguing either that the role is, that it's okay for us to have this social role, or that people don't have problems like this. Acting like this can be a real problem. And I'm glad people have talked about codependency. The original work in codependency came out of something called family systems therapy. And what they did in family systems therapy is they concentrated on the system, on how people interacted with each other. But when codependency became popularized, it turned into a personality disorder, just like the earlier ones we were talking about. And people began to say, you personally are sick because you were brought up in a particular kind of family. And if you read the codependency books, you find that they have a sort of Freudian theory about demanding father, demanding and distant father, and those sorts of things, about why women become codependent. So that they turn it into a personality disorder. It's a problem with you if you act this way. Acting this way is a problem. What I want to do is to say, it may not be a problem with you. It may be a larger problem. If you look at the codependency literature and say, well, what do you do to get better? You become the stereotypical man. To get better, you become independent, you become selfish without feeling guilty, you get self-reliant, you live serenely without being hooked by the unhappiness and problems of others, you develop more of a, quote, self, you're able to say no to the demands of others, and you want to be loved without being needed. This is the stereotypical man's role in our society. But the codependency movement has defined this as a getting better of your personality. So I become a better person when I do this. Well, here what we've got then is the devaluing of the feminine's role and calling it a sickness. And taking the male role and saying, and this is healthy. So if you want to be healthy, get a sex change operation. But they're real expensive. I haven't sort of directly hit on why I think this is a real problem, but I'm sure a lot of you have picked this up. I want to do one more example before we begin to talk about why it's a problem. I want to give you another personality description and have you think about who you think this kind of person might be. For those folks on the tape, This is a silent, untrusting, frightened person who's constantly startled by noises, often thinks people are out to get her or him, and sometimes lapses into paranoid delusions. They often have nightmares and trouble sleeping. They are often withdrawn and uncommunicative and disorganized in his or her thinking. This is a standard description of post-traumatic stress caused by torture. What this personality description describes is torture victims. We have a center for therapy with torture victims in Minneapolis that does a lot of work with torture victims from around the world. This description brings home very pointedly the problem with calling this a personality problem. If you call this a personality problem, what you do is you fix the victim of torture. And you don't fix the society that did the torture. And I think you can take that very same analysis and use it to talk about these people. So what you do is you fix the stereotypical woman and make her better instead of fixing the society that makes the role the way it is. Does that make sense?
When the person is already having the problem, they do need help, not just the society.
I agree. So it's not bad to care about the individual. And in fact, you should care deeply. That's why they have this center in Minneapolis. And they do therapy with these folks. And it's based on post-traumatic stress kinds of stuff, which you see both from torture and from people from Vietnam, those sorts of things.
What about sexual abuse in childhood?
Post-traumatic stress is sort of the standard thing for childhood sexual abuse too, yeah. But what you want to do is not to simply say, this is a problem with this person's psychology. You have to say, gosh, let's help this person. But you have to also say, let's try to look at what caused this person to become this way.
Don't you think we're doing that so much so that individual people don't realize the power within themselves to fix their problems themselves? Because
I think,
they look for the cause outside.
Yeah.
And that's something that they can't control anyway.
I think that's an important balance that we're going to have to talk about. One of what you're pointing out is a balance between looking for a story about what happened, about why things happened to the situation or to the individual. And what I'd like to come to is an understanding that it's much more complex than simply saying it's one or the other. And it's hugely more complex than simply saying, get a life. Because you could say to somebody like this, well, just get a life. My wife runs a rape crisis counseling center in Minnesota, and she has talked with people whose method of therapy with folks like that who are unhappy is simply to say, well, be happy. Smile. It's your responsibility to be happy. You know, and if they're in a home where they can't get out, the husband beats them all the time, and if they leave, the husband is going to chase them down, and they don't have any skills, then you have to look both at the situation and at the responsibility that the woman has to take in order to leave. You can't do just one or the other. And I think what we're so prone to do in our culture is to sort of pick an answer right? And to say, oh, it's sin. And if that person would just stop sinning, then they'd be better. Or to pick an answer and just say, oh, it's social stuff. And now we'll fix the social stuff and there won't be a problem. And in fact, what it is a really complex interaction between all of them. Let's see if I've written down anything. More important, I have to say. No? So the take-home point that I wanted to use as just a starter for talking is that by focusing on personality as the cause of the problem, which is what I think the popular codependency movement does, we overlook issues of justice. We overlook social issues of justice. And the torture victim example, I think, makes that really clear. Because you can do a psychological diagnosis of a victim of torture and say, well, that's their personality disorder. And God knows it's true. They've got a personality problem. And they need serious help with it. But it's also true that we need organizations like Amnesty International to help change societies and stop torture. I really do want to get to this issue of balance between situation and personal initiative. But I also want to sort of do some cleanup on the issue of codependency, because it's really a prevalent thing in our culture right now. What are the justice issues that are hiding in codependency? Does that question make sense?
Before we address that,
sure.
Is it possible for people who are codependent to be helped the way that they're being approached now and the way the problem is being approached now?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, it's possible. And here's... Here's the thing that you need to think about, though, with the codependency movement and how they help people. You need to think about people who are in situations where they are codependent. So we will call these folks people who are codependent. We need to talk about people who are not codependent. Not caught. Oh well. And we need to talk about people who go through this kind of codependent movement approach.
Yeah, such as the 12-step programs.
Such as the 12-step programs. And they do help some people. So, you know, I don't want to fall into dichotomies and say, oh, they're horrible, everything they do is bad. So people who go through some of the programs. And then the people who don't do the programs. And in order to find out if the programs are really useful in general, you have to say how many people succeed who go through the programs, and how many people... Actually, let's do it this way.
What's your definition of success?
We'll get to that in a second. So people who aren't helped by the movement, who go through it.
Can't read what you wrote.
Okay, this is people who do well and people who are not helped. So you need to look at people who go into these 12-step programs who do well and are helped by it. And there are people who do the programs that are helped by it. But there are also people who do the programs that are not helped. And you need to look at people who don't do the programs and see if they do better later in terms of being less codependent, getting out of abusive relationships. You know, we can come up with a variety of criteria to talk about what we think success would be. The point isn't what the criteria is, it's that we need to look at both the people who go through the programs and do well and those who don't. So simple...
And those who don't go through the programs and do well.
And do well and don't. That's right. All
are
of those...
Are all these people still living with a dependent...
You could use as your criteria whether they move out or not if you want. It's, you know, it's sort of up to you what criteria you want to use to say this has been successful. But the point I'm simply trying to make is that we need to look at all four of these kinds of outcomes in order to decide if the codependent, if the 12-step programs are really helping folks. In fact, there are a fair number
of... If there is that one quarter at all of people who go through the program and get help,
right,
then sure, they're worth doing.
Yes.
Anybody, one person getting help,
that's right,
worth doing.
That's right.
Well, I don't know about that. You know, the whole idea of having...
If I'm with one person, believe me, it's important.
But if you create false hope and false treatment, it's like giving a bad drug to a person. It actually makes them worse. Is that one person justifiably a good cause for traumatizing?
300 other people say.
Yeah,
sure, let's make it 3,000 other people if you want to make it hard. You see, and this is what I said at the beginning of this session, that what I intend to do is to make you more confused rather than to give you easy answers to this. What I want to do is to give you more complex ways to think about issues like codependency. And we'll, you know, and we don't have to just do codependency, not to pick on women. We can also talk about the men's movement. And if you look at some of the standard approaches in the men's movement, they are also these personality-based things. Instead of talking about men's role in society, they talk about how I, as a man, have been hurt by my relationship with my father and how that causes a personality problem for me. So you don't have to just do women. You can do it in a whole variety of things.
Not being a man,
I
haven't even heard of this before.
Oh, yeah. There's a large... It started in Minnesota, so I've heard it. But there are a large number of people who go through this 12-step programs and are not helped. And some of them actually feel that they've been harmed by the 12-step program. And we have to think carefully about those people, too.
Is that true for people who are, say, alcoholics or whatever, go through the 12-step?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, that's also true for Alcoholics Anonymous, those sorts of things. There are people who help by it. There are people who are not helped by it. Let me give you another interesting statistic, which I think strikes right at the heart of this question of whether wives of alcoholic men, and I'll say it that way because it's really what we're talking about, although we can take the gender out of it if you feel like it. And wives of alcoholic men are codependent because of a personality problem. There have, in fact, been studies done of personalities of wives of alcoholic men versus wives of non-alcoholic men. No differences. You don't get the differences. The problem isn't the personality of the woman. The problem... Right. The problem isn't the personality of her personality. The problem is the situation she's in.
So your original question about justice, then, is about that we're focusing on, we're calling a victim a perpetrator to a certain extent.
Yes.
And that we have, that what we need to do is focus on and more on those people who are harming other people in their lives.
Or the way our society does,
right.
It, yeah.
I don't want to move off of this at all, but I can see how this is happening on one Indian reservation in Montana, I believe, where you have alcoholic treatment and a high dropout rate and high pregnancy rate among young people. And I've been reading a book written by a woman named Artie Clark, who's I believe she's a psychologist, who has interviewed these same young people who are those who are dropping out, who are and then going into rehabilitation for drugs many times and not being cured. And one of the things they say is that I dropped out of school because my history professor doesn't like Indians. and said so over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. That is a repeated problem.
Yes.
It is not ever addressed in the community. And that's the injustice.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
They don't want to hear about
that's
it.
Right.
I said to this one government teacher, how much do you teach about tribal history and government? Though that outfit, now this guy wonders, how come the young people are dropping out of his class?
Yes. Yeah, so the justice issue you're pointing out there is that it's easy to concentrate on the personality of the dropout
right. And
not the thing they're dropping out from.
Right, and why.
And in the codependency movement, it's easy to concentrate on the personality of the woman who is trapped in this situation. Let me put it another way. It is easy to concentrate... It's easy to ignore the straitjacket and concentrate on the person who's wearing the straitjacket. So here they are in a situation that constrains them. And we say, let's fix your head. Now, some people, it helps. And I don't want to deny that. I think it really does help some people to think that way. But often the way it helps is it helps them to get out of the relationships or to change the way they act in the relationships.
Isn't a lot that's happening though nowadays is more of breaking patterns? Maybe because we talk about it. 20, 30 years ago, they didn't even have a word such as codependent.
Yes.
And 20, 30 years ago, there was no abuse. There was no sexual abuse. There was no emotional abuse because nobody talked about it.
As far as we were concerned.
And, right. I mean it facetiously. And so I think I see an awful lot of people just trying and struggling very hard to break patterns.
Yes.
And when you don't know any better, you know no other pattern because you haven't had anybody show you that pattern.
Yes.
It's almost an impossible task so that... No matter what's going on in your life, no matter how, if you even are aware that there's a difference that can be made, that there
That's
is
right.
a different way of doing things, whether it's a 12-step program, whether it's a class you take, whether it's something you read in a book or a paper, any of these things are okay as long as you're doing the awareness. And that's going to take just lots of time.
That's right. And again, I don't want to be misunderstood as ripping on the codependency movement. I think they have done some tremendous things for people and have really made people aware of the problem. And it's not like people in the codependency movement aren't aware of the straitjacket either. I mean, they know about that. They know about the problems in the family system. The thing I'm complaining about is the tendency that we have in America to slip into these personality descriptions. And I'm going to talk later in the week. I do this so I can get you back with it. I'm going to talk later in the week about why we have this tendency to focus on personality descriptions. And I think it's true that we do. When we see a person, we think more about what kind of person is that?
Chuck,
instead of what kind
me?
Of situation has produced their behavior. Yeah.
Well, can you tell me if these studies have been done, people who have the food programs have done well? And the ones that have been through the programs that have not been helped? I mean, are you suggesting there's a third category, that there's people who have been through the programs that have been harmed?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm suggesting there is that category.
But are those numbers known? Is
that no. As far as... I can't say that... That's incorrect. I don't know if the studies have been done. In fact, it's not my area of research, so I don't keep up on it, though. The problem with social science research is that there's so much of it.
I didn't hear what category that you said yes to. I didn't hear what she said there.
Okay, the question was, is there a category of people who go through 12-step programs and are harmed?
Okay.
And my answer to that is yes. And you don't need studies to get that. All you need is one or two examples, sort of existence proofs of people who are hurt. But I can't give you percentages.
Could you tell us a story?
Sure. I'd be glad to give you an example like that. And by the way, to make a plug for the book that's in the bookstore, Carol Tavris's Mismeasure of Woman gives a whole lot of examples about this. And one of the ones I'm going to give you is out of this book. So it's very good. The kind of move that Carol Tavris makes, she's another social psychologist, that's why I like her. The kind of move that she makes in the book is to say that what we've been doing for years is measuring health, measuring goodness by male standards, and then taking things that happen to women and saying, they're different, therefore they're sick. So premenstrual syndrome, she says, there's a whole lot of evidence that yes, there is a small medical problem, but it's nowhere near as big as the drug companies would like to make money on. And so she talks about both the medical issues, and she also talks about some of these personality issues, and I must admit, I'm better on the personality than I am on the medical. You were going to ask
me? I was going to say, there's another whole thing with women as the baby boomers start to go into menopause.
Yes.
And that whole thing with the estrogen replacement.
Yes, menopause is sickness.
Yeah, and right. This whole thing and how the medical profession and the drug companies are
just salivating to make lots of money off of menopause as a sickness rather than as, you know, and here's a sickness that happens to 100% of the women. Let me get back to the story. The story that is of people who go to 12-step programs and are told by them that because they have a certain kind of personality that they need to remain in that program forever to continue to get help. See, and this is where the personality thing comes in, to which I object. It's not you have a bad situation and learn to get out of it and get better. But in many of the 12-step programs, and some of you who are in 12-step programs may be in ones who don't do this. Again, I don't want to issue a blanket condemnation. But in at least some of them, they have this ideology that since it's a problem with you, you have to stay in the 12-step program all the time because you are a codependent person.
That's different than saying it's learned behavior?
That's different from saying it's learned and you can unlearn. Mm-hmm. It's different from saying that it's rational behavior that happens if you're in a situation. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that the behavior of many women who are in abusive relationships is perfectly reasonable. And it's the very sort of thing that any of us would do in a relationship in order to try to survive if we were caught in it that way. And they need support to get out of those relationships. So, you know, those are the kinds of examples of people who... And the heart of that particular example turns on my objection, which is that we've called it a personality problem that you've got and it's going to be with you forever. Yeah.
I was just wondering about codependency can be a lot different than alcoholism.
Yes.
Alcoholism is a drug as opposed to
yes.
codependency. I mean, that's it.
Yeah.
To me, perfect.
But there are 12-step programs that work for both, or that are used for both, and that's why we've been overlapping.
Okay, because it's kind of hard for me to compare alcoholism to codependency because alcoholism
yes.
is a drug. I mean, it's an addiction.
That's right. The
so
main the reason
alcoholic
that,
does need to consider that they will always be an alcoholic and continue to go to 12-step programs, or
well, again, the research on that is iffy. 12-step programs have been wonderful help for many alcoholics. In fact, it's one of the best kinds of therapies that you can do. On the other hand, with many 12-step AA programs do is say you can never drink again ever. They do this sort of dichotomizing and say you know perhaps you could go back as a social drinker. My question, and it's a real problem. My question is this based on just fear, and ideology? No, this decision that it's only on the wagon or in the gutter? Or is it based on a real understanding of alcoholism? There may well be people who can drink socially and don't become alcoholics. I think there's one or two in this room who drink socially and aren't alcoholics.
But what you could be saying, by the statements you're making, you could be saying to someone in this room who's sitting on some type of a shaky path, you could be giving them their death sentence.
I know.
And I'm not willing to try that. Personally, I'm not willing to try to see whether I can social drink.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know I can't. I've worked with too many people who slipped.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen what happens. They die from the disease, and I'm not willing to take that chance.
Yes.
And so for me, everyone has their own individual kind of process, but I know what works for me.
Right.
And so I'm not willing to take that chance.
And
it's scary hearing a public speaker say something to that effect, mm-hmm. because I think that if you had somebody who was shaky, they'd say, Chuck said it's okay.
I don't say it's okay.
Okay, I think you need to clear that. Make me real clear on that.
Yeah, well, I was getting to that point.
Oh, okay.
Again, what I said earlier is that, you see, the get on the wagon thing, and I don't want to get off on alcoholism too much, but, you know, the get on the wagon thing is this dichotomizing. And what I'm saying is we need to think much more carefully about it. And for people who have had a serious problem with alcohol, they need to think very, very carefully before they try to drink socially. And for many people, it won't work. So I'm not saying go ahead and try it. But what I'm saying is we need to think more carefully and complexly about it than simply saying either you do or you don't. For everybody, all the time.
Could I briefly challenge a dichotomizing that we could be slipping into here?
Sure.
And I just have a little concern about that. Joe Cruz, the fellow that started the Betty Ford Foundation, was mm-hmm. concerned about his alcoholism, and he was nearly died and blah, blah, blah. But he said that once he got straight with that kind of stuff, what he realized was that his disease of codependency was much more, I'm using his jargon,
sure.
was much, much more deeply permeated his own difficulties and the difficulties in our society. And the dichotomy that I'm a little concerned about, I'm not questioning the idea that we have to change where the society is, but what we've almost possibly slipped into here is that in any addictive relationship, the codependency is every bit as strong in the male as it is in the female.
Mm-hmm.
If you use co-addiction mm-hmm. and codependency synonymously.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like we've slipped into here, as I hear it, that there are more codependent women than there are codependent men. I think it looks different. I think it's a discrete description of a certain number of behaviors, but I think us guys have got every bit as much of it as women do. And I'd be a little concerned that we would slip into thinking it's more a women thing than a man thing. I don't think that's true. At least I'd like to question that.
Yeah, and I'm not sure. You know, I just don't know.
But I don't want to go down that path, even in this discussion, to imply that because stereotypically it's a limitation we place on women to say, therefore, let's walk out of here thinking, well, maybe women have that discrete bunch of behaviors more than men do. I don't think mm-hmm. that's probably true.
Yeah, and again, I'm not familiar enough with it to know.
Having been involved in a 12-step program myself, I kind of think, too, it's, you know, there's a thing like with the alcoholic, but then we also have the workaholic,
mm-hmm.
who is so valued in this culture.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, so we have this, that alcoholic is this terrible person, but then we have all these other addictive personalities, but sort
That's
of
right.
like, you know, there's this really, I've never really seen too much treatment for workaholism. And I think that is a real big problem. In our
because
country.
It's too valued, we want people to work.
But I think
sometimes you're right.
using the word, you know, we're using addiction because I think a lot of it, that our whole culture is quite addictive. I mean, whether you're buying
mm-hmm.
all kinds of toys, to make you feel good, or you're drinking, or you're using sex, relationships, work. I mean, I bet everybody in this room, maybe there's a few that aren't, but I bet most of us have some kind of addiction.
Yeah, well, and again, it depends upon how broadly you use the word addiction. If you use it to say physical addiction or sort of behavioral addiction. You had your hand up.
Just talking from a sociological perspective,
mm-hmm.
Is it kind of like that the females have been taught previously by the roles and the norms to be taught to be codependent and be expressive about it, as opposed to the males, who probably are just equally codependent but haven't been?
That's right. Males could, and you know, this was the comment earlier about the fellow who's now left, males could easily be experiencing many of the same kinds of feelings that are listed here, which is caring deeply about how other people think about them, etc. But it's more stereotypically a role that women have in our society. So yeah, I agree with you in that sense, but I don't know the research. Part of what I'm attempting to do in this is to ask the question, how much mileage do we get out of calling this a personality disorder rather than calling it a problem with our society? And I think perhaps workaholism is a good example of that problem. Workaholism may well not be a personality disorder. It's a disorder of our society because we value work so much. Or, and now we're back to the issue of balance, it's probably a combination of these. So, you know, we have people's choice and their willingness to engage or not engage in certain behaviors, and we have situations that we know influence people. This situation, I talk the most because I'm supposed to be the leader, right? And there's at least 6 feet between me and anybody else in this room. Nobody else came and sat right up next to me up here. Because that's certain, you know, so situations do influence our behavior. But they interact. We choose situations. We choose whether we go to church or not. We choose whether we come to hold it or not. And those situations influence how we act. So it's not one or the other. It's both together interacting. And I think it's dangerous when we slip to either side of this and either call it a personality problem or simply say it's a social problem. And we are within a few minutes of being over. Do other folks have? Yeah, you've had your hand up. I'm sorry.
Thomas Sowers wrote a book, Insanity, the Idea and Its Consequences.
Yes.
In other words, what does it mean to society when we say some people are so out of control of their behavior that they can't be considered criminals, you know,
yes.
They don't fall under the same rules. And that's kind of what you're saying, codependency and its consequences.
Yes.
It's an idea and its consequences.
That's right. And yet we have to think about the consequences of calling codependency a personality disorder rather than thinking more complexly about the issue of codependency. Again, I'm not saying there isn't codependency. It's obvious there is. But we need to think about the causes of it, how it's produced, and the consequences for our society of naming it a personality disorder.
We're taught not to think in those terms. At least I think modern society is going that way. Something like codependency appears on the bookshelves and we all read it, we hear about it on talk shows, and we start applying it to ourselves rather than examining whether it's a true idea or not.
That's right.
What it really means to
that's
society.
Right. That's right. And that's part of what
be able to jump on the bed.
That's right, and that's part of what I'm hoping that we will get out of this series of conversations is some practice at thinking carefully about these kinds of psychological movements.
I have a friend who was in a situation that was producing a codependent personality in her. That situation does not exist anymore. But this friend continues to almost to create life around her to duplicate it over and over again. And then she doesn't really like it.
That's right.
But doesn't seem to know how to stop doing it.
Right.
So it's like she's the straitjacket thing you talked about, maybe. Mm-hmm. And I thought, how can she learn what the straitjacket is so she can stop wearing it?
So she can avoid it. That's right. And see, that's very... But I like the way you said that, because that's a very different way from than saying, what's wrong with her that she keeps creating straitjackets? And that's, I think, an unhelpful way to think about it.
If she isn't recognizing the straitjacket, she's just going to keep putting it on again and again.
That's
without
right.
realizing.
But if we can
use
talk...
that imagery with a student who, his father just went through a treatment this last year, and she just feels so healthy because she's learned about her codependency, and she's got a boyfriend that just
yes.
is exactly like her father. And
that's right.
I've been trying to figure out now. Let's see.
That's right.
Can we talk about this?
All right, and I think and I think part of the reason that happens is because many people, again, you know, I'm beating the drum on this issue of personality. What many people who think about codependency that way end up doing is getting involved in thinking about themselves and their own responses and feelings and